Long paid video production fellowships here in our New York studio. Learn more at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices of a People's History, a movement of movements, on Wednesday, July 10th, from 6 to 9 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. Voices of a People's History celebrates diverse movement leaders by sharing their stories. Members of our community perform readings of notable speeches and essays from inspiring figures past and present, a radically empowering opportunity to hear the echoes of history in the present day. Again, that's Voices of a People's History, a movement of movements, on Wednesday, July 10th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of People of the Drum on Saturday, July 13th from 2 to 4 p.m. at Gateway Discovery Park in Portland. People in the Drum is a concert celebrating the universal voice of the drum from the Native, Mexican, African, and Japanese cultures. Performers include the Painted Sky North Star Dancers, Metikia Yawi, the Alex Addy Drummers, and Portland Taiko. There will also be drumming workshops for youth and more. That's the People of the Drum on Saturday, July 13th from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Gateway Discovery Park, 10520 Northeast Halsey Street in Portland. More information can be found at kaboo.fm on the right side of home page under Community Events.
It is a minute past 5, and coming up next we have KBOO Evening News. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, daily soup specials, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. Open daily until 6 p.m. More information on the Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, two people arrested at the city sweep of Jason Barnes Landing have had all charges dropped, kind of.
Congress is looking more closely at the use of facial recognition software.
And in international news, the UK ambassador to the United States has resigned after a series of diplomatic cables were leaked wherein the ambassador called Donald Trump inept and clumsy.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 10th, 2019. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Leslie McLam. The State Department of Fish and Wildlife has authorized the killing of members of a wolf pack that occupy land in northeastern Washington state. The move comes after a cow was found dead and partially consumed by wolves. Agents with the state say that the intention of killing members of the OPT pack is to alter the pack's behavior. Conservation groups claim that the repeated killing of wolves in the same area does not decrease attacks on cattle. Wolves were wiped out of the state in the 1930s in an attempt to protect livestock.
Yesterday, Portland officials swept the houseless camp at Jason Barnes Landing in North Portland. Two people were arrested, including Chief, who has spoken several times on the KBOO News over the past week. KBOO's Lisa Loving caught up with organizer Mimi Gurman, Chief, and Peter Parks, who had all charges dropped against them. Kind of.
Well, Jason, he was a like I say, he was a real small man, and people were, all these people that loved him, he was crying and pleading with us for it. And as older people, we dropped the ball here. We really should have done this a long time ago. Since he's passed away, we've lost four other people in this community here. Overdoses, there are two overdoses here. And this is really, it's really tragic. We could have helped these people. We could have stopped this. And other people, I feel like we dropped the ball. We should have been on this a long time ago. And Ted Wheeler, I don't know where he's at, man. He really got to be a special kind of person to displace folks and not, with all the resources he has, not provide for them. He's supposed to be in charge of the city here. I don't see it. I don't see what he's doing.
The state of Oregon awarded its single biggest procurement ever, and surprisingly, it was through the Oregon Health Authority. 11 coordinated care organizations, or CCOs, all already delivering services, will split the $6 billion pie, most with five-year contracts. The state hopes these new contracts will reduce costs, improve access to mental health services, and reward providers for improving health for Oregon's 1 million Medicare recipients. One of the big winners was Trillium Community Health Plan, which currently serves only Lane County, but will expand to the Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties, giving it the largest potential customer base of any CCO. In 2015, the physician group that had started Trillium sold it to Centene, a for-profit health insurance company that's the second largest publicly traded corporation based in Missouri. Pacific Source of Portland also had an expansion approved into Lane, Marion, and Polk counties, nearly quadrupling its customers from 60,000 to 235,000. Moda Health's bid to expand into four more counties was rejected, but its contract for Eastern Oregon was renewed. Primary Health, currently serving over 10,000 customers in Josephine County, was the only incumbent CCO to be rejected. Four other incumbent CCOs, operating mostly in Southwest Oregon, were limited by the state to one-year contracts rather than the normal five because the health authority has significant concerns about their operations.
On June 29th, the Portland Police Bureau tweeted a warning that leftist protesters might have mixed quick-drying cement with vegan milkshakes to throw at police and other protesters. Why the police made this tweet, we may never know. But thanks to the investigative journalists at Willamette Week, we know the rumor was false. Pictorial evidence in the current issue showing a bandanaed mannequin splashed with both regular and concrete added milkshakes shows the shakes in question were just food, construction material free. Not that the two couldn't be mixed, but the difference between the two when hurled would be obvious to anyone.
Local scientists say that a new House bill may be putting Oregonians in danger. House Bill 3309 allows for the development of schools, hospitals, and police and fire stations in tsunami zones. After magnitude earthquakes hit Southern California last week, scientists raised concerns over similar quakes and subsequent tsunamis that they say can and will happen off of Oregon's shores. For those in tsunami zones, when an earthquake hits, there's a mere 15 to 20 minutes of time to reach high ground. Those who are unable to do so won't fare well against the storm. By developing these areas, the many fear that the new law will put coastal towns at risk. The bill passed through the state legislature quickly, with Governor Kate Brown signing it into law in late June. Advocates for the bill say that restricting where critical services can be built stifles coastal communities. Brian Boquist, the Republican senator who recently made headlines after making threatening statements, was the only Oregon senator to vote against the bill, saying, quote, this bill's passing shows the state of Oregon does not care about the lives of its citizens.
The Portland Police Union contract is up for renegotiation next year, and local organizers are getting ready to push for different terms. The KBOO News spoke with James Offsink of Portland's Resistance about a demonstration for police accountability this Thursday at 4:30 p.m. across from City Hall.
This Thursday, we're rallying across from City Hall, so at Terry Shrunk Plaza on the western side of the park in full view of City Hall to make sure that City Council and other city decision makers know how important it is to the community to have a fair, justice-oriented contract.
All right. So talk, can you fill in our listeners a little bit on why the police union contract negotiations are so key?
Definitely. I think we're at a really unique moment right now. And I think some of that grows out of the national movement for Black Lives and other national events. You know, I think you'd have to be really ignoring media at all to have never seen any, you know, cell phone videos of police misconduct or to have read any of the sensationalized headlines about corruption or various forms of lawbreaking within police bureaus across the country. And so because of that public pressure and because of the research that national folks with Black Lives Matter and Campaign Zero and other groups have done, it's really brought into focus how important police union contracts are in cities as both kind of protecting the worst officers, the most likely to use violence against community members, the most likely to be abusing their power in different ways, and how that creates a culture within police bureaus that is kind of a downward negative cycle, making sure that the most, the best, most community-minded police officers don't see the bureau as a place where they can continue to do good work, and you know, people who think of it as just a job or are not fully respectful of their power and authority continue to thrive and advance.
And so there are certain things I think about the Portland Police Union contract that are perhaps unique or rare nationally. Can you talk a little bit about the terms of the contract that you think are, that Portland's resistance is trying to focus on?
Yeah, there are a lot of different areas that the contract could be improved. The police union has been really strong bargainers in the past, and we think that the city has negotiated kind of a series of poor contracts. But we've really focused our efforts around two kind of key areas. One around true officer accountability. It is almost impossible to fire a police officer in the city of Portland. And we actually saw this play out just recently in the last few months. The city council voted 4-1 to pay Sergeant Greg Lewis over $100,000 so that he would stay retired after making a racist comment during a morning briefing. And every city councilor who testified said that, well, this is not, you know, the right outcome. Nobody wants to be paying six figures of Portland taxpayer money for something that should be a fireable offense. But four of the city councilors felt that their hands were tied by the police union contract and said, hey, the community needs to come back when we're negotiating this contract, and we, the community, are now back, and this is the time. So that's one area, is having real accountability for officers. And the second area is civilian oversight. So if you are a member of the community and have a complaint against an individual officer, against the bureau, there's kind of a Byzantine series of different ways that complaint could be heard, but probably it would go to the Independent Police Review Board, which is a board composed in part of community members and part of police staff. And that board, which tries to be independent, does not have the ability to compel officer testimony and does not have really as much power as they should have in order to both investigate police misconduct and complaints against the police bureau, and also then ultimately to either recommend or enforce some kind of disciplinary action against bad actors. So those are the two areas that we're really kind of focusing most closely on this, in this campaign, although there are, and we have kind of posted on our website a number, a broader range of asks, but those are the two highest areas, accountability and true independent civilian oversight.
And just to be clear, James, when we're talking about the police union contract, it's basically the legal, it's the legal framework for how the bureau operates, basically. It sets up the laws and framework through which people can sue or not sue if they don't feel that they've been treated correctly. I mean, can you just talk a little bit about, I mean, you touched on it briefly, but what does the contract mean? What is its power?
Well, it, at the most basic level, the contract sets up the agreement between the city and the residents of the city, so the city kind of acting on behalf of all of us in Portland, and the several hundred member Portland Police's Association. And it, a lot of it specifies basically stuff around, you know, benefits and pay and all of that, but then importantly, there's a tremendous amount of policy that's also enshrined within the contract. So there's information about the use of body cams. There's information about who is allowed to ask police officers who are suspected of committing some kind of crime, who's allowed to ask them questions and under what circumstances. And if the an attorney or investigator representing the city is out of boundaries of any of what's in the contract, then it calls into jeopardy the entire investigation into a bad act within the police bureau. So there's a lot in there that is more than just what you think of as a kind of a normal labor contract with surrounding benefits and compensation and what the fair process for discipline is going to be. And instead, this contract has really, and many police contracts across the country have grown to be much more than that, and to really bind the hands of people who are interested in criminal justice reform, people who are interested in pushing for just having a better, more community-centered police department overall.
Now I have to ask you a tough question. Do you remember some few years ago when there was a Portland police political demonstration outside of City Hall, and it had to do with Officer Frashour, who was accused of multiple wrongdoing when he was a Portland police officer, and hundreds of police officers with blue t-shirts that said, "We are all Frashour," marched and basically kind of swarmed downtown Portland. Now, do you remember this?
I don't remember it personally, but I do know that Frashour was the officer, I believe, who was involved in killing civilian James Chasey, is that right? And the circumstances surrounding it were pretty horrific, and I have friends who are more involved in criminal justice reform at that point, and the message of "we are all Frashour" is one that certainly
it backfired, kind of,
citizens of Portland up at night. Yeah, I mean, definitely backfired. And yet you see the city really is concerned about these strong shows of demonstration, solidarity by the police. And so, you know, that's why it's so important for people to turn up now. These contracts do last for 4 to 5 years typically, and also every contract that gets signed has kind of a ripple effect, because as arbitrators who are deciding typically between the city's offer for a contract and the Portland police's offer for a contract, when they're deciding which contract will become the final one, they take into account other contracts in the region. So we really feel like this moment is important not just for the people of Portland, but really people throughout the region, throughout the entire state, where other police association contracts will be looking at ours, and also to similarly positioned cities, Seattle, Sacramento, et cetera. So it really is kind of a moment where if people care about the movement for Black Lives, if people care about officer accountability, if they care about ending our mass incarceration nation, we really hope that people will show up on Thursday and make sure that the city knows that it's not just police who are interested and invested in this contract, but it's really something that matters to everyone.
Okay, and that's Thursday at 4:30 p.m. in front, across the street from City Hall. James Offsink, Portland's Resistance. How do people connect with your organization and participate in this campaign?
Yeah, I mean, definitely we'll have more information at the rally on Thursday afternoon. If people are not able to come to the rally, then probably connecting with us on social media. We are PDX Resistance on Facebook and Twitter, and we're going to be working in coalition with other groups, including Portland Cop Watch, the Albina Ministerial Alliance, the Urban League. There's a whole bunch of groups that are really interested in this issue and recognize both how important it is and what kind of an opportunity we have, especially with the first time in Portland history having a police reform activist and advocate actually sitting in City Hall, which I think changes the calculus a lot.
James Offsink, thanks for taking a few minutes to talk with us today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on, Lisa.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
U.S. Labor Secretary Alexander Acosta has proposed an 80% cut in funding for the International Labor Affairs Bureau, the government agency that combats child sex trafficking. Major cuts to the ILAB's funding exposes endangered children to increased risk of sex trafficking and also undermines the U.S. government's anti-human trafficking efforts. Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark believes Acosta's proposed funding cuts for the Department of Labor 2020 fiscal year, combined with the lenient plea deal he granted to Epstein in 2008, prove that, quote, the Labor Secretary did not see protecting vulnerable children as a priority. Acosta has come under fire recently for his role in a plea deal that was cut to Jeffrey Epstein while he was the U.S. Attorney for Florida's Southern District. Several high-ranking Democrats have called for his resignation.
Congress discussed use of facial recognition software today. KBOO's Alex Connor has this story.
A hearing was held this morning with the House Committee on Homeland Security regarding government use of facial recognition and other biometric technologies. Officials from the TSA, Customs, Secret Service, and the Department of Commerce were questioned for a little over 2 hours this morning about the use of facial recognition systems, which are currently being used in some airports and at border crossings. Officials are hoping to secure funding to widen implementation of a program that's currently being tested at Atlanta's International Airport, where travelers' photos are being taken on site and checked against those on their passports or visas. Several questions were raised about system accuracy, citing among others an ACLU study that was run with photographs of Congress members, in which 28 members' photos were mismatched with those of criminals on record. In 40% of those mismatches, the subjects were women and/or people of color, an area in which these systems have proven to be considerably less accurate. There were also questions raised about privacy and data security. When asked what happens with the data collected, officials insisted that photos of U.S. citizens are heavily encrypted and only kept in their database for 12 hours, while those of foreign travelers are entered into a DHS database and are kept for a longer period of time. Some committee members also expressed concern over a data breach that was reported last month, where photographs of more than 50,000 drivers and license plates obtained at an unnamed Canadian border crossing were hacked from the system of a subcontractor and uploaded to the web. Some committee members also raised concerns over warrantless surveillance and potential abuses of power, citing the FBI's tactics in their battle with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in the 1960s. The committee was assured by the panel that the programs currently in place are strictly used for travel screening and are not currently being used for general surveillance. A further private hearing is set to be held in the future. We'll keep you posted. For KBOO Evening News, this is Alex Connor.
Oregon's only woman on death row is set to receive a retrial. In 2011, Angela McNulty was convicted of aggravated murder for the torture and starvation of her 15-year-old daughter, Jeanette Maples. In a draft ruling, Senior Circuit Court Judge J. Burdett Pratt said that McNulty deserves a retrial due to her attorney's failure to adequately defend and advise their client during her trial. McNulty immediately pleaded guilty after her lawyers advised her to do so, even though the prosecution had yet to outrule the death penalty. Jurors unanimously chose the death penalty. Prior to Jeanette's death, she wrote a letter to a school official saying she was beaten, starved, and given gruesome punishments. The Oregon Department of Human Services investigated the claims by visiting McNulty's home, but closed the case without taking measures to protect the young teenager.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 6 for Right to Survive Radio. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be patchy fog with a low of 63 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will again be fog, giving way to partly sunny skies with a high of 80 degrees. Today in history, in 1976, in Seveso, Italy, near Milan, an explosion in a chemical factory released about 6 metric tons of toxic dioxin gas. Within days, a total of 3,300 animals, mostly poultry and rabbits, were found dead. By 1978, over 80,000 animals had been killed. The quote of the day is from Canadian short story writer Alice Munro, whose 87th birthday is today. Munro said, quote, "The complexity of things, the things within things, just seems to be endless. I mean, nothing is easy, nothing is simple."
Now it's time for the Green News Report. 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, and analysis with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen.
It's Tuesday, July 9, 2019.
At our level, we are doing numbers that nobody's seen before. Nobody believes what we're doing and what we're producing electricity and other things for.
Trump gives a speech to tout his administration's environmental accomplishments. Yep, that really happened. Plus,
this is a heat wave on steroids.
Record heat waves in Europe and the Arctic make June 2019 the hottest June ever recorded.
All of those records and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
When I went to California, they sort of scoffed at me for the first 2 weeks and maybe 3 weeks and not so much 4 weeks. And after about 5 weeks, they said, you know, he's right.
Nope. No, he didn't. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, Donald Trump's touting of his own accomplishments aside, it was 90 degrees in Fairbanks, Alaska over July 4?
Yes, it was. But before we go there, first, June 2019 was the hottest June ever recorded globally. That's according to the European Union's Climate Data Agency. And it was thanks in part to the record extreme heat wave that gripped Europe and broke numerous heat records in several countries, including shattering France's all-time highest temperature record. And the worst heat of summer hasn't even started yet. Climate scientists at the World Weather Attribution Group concluded in an analysis that the European heat wave was made at least 5 times more likely because of man-made global warming.
Yeah, well, what do those scientists know about science?
Plus, for the first time in recorded history, as you mentioned, parts of Alaska hit a record 90 degrees over the 4th of July weekend, part of an extended heat wave. Climate scientists have linked both of these record heat waves in Alaska and in Europe to a slowdown in the jet stream that's triggered by the loss of sea ice in the Arctic, which acts as a sort of thermostat for the planet. Climate scientists warn that extreme heat waves are becoming more frequent and severe due to climate change, and worse, they're hitting more frequently than climate models had previously predicted.
They keep giving us all of this science as if we're supposed to do something with it.
Well, that is the idea.
Oh.
In Washington, D.C. on Monday, a sudden torrential rainfall of 4 inches an hour in some areas produced life-threatening flooding, according to the National Weather Service, and stranded motorists and forced high-water rescues. NOAA has confirmed that since the 1950s, heavy rainfall events have increased in the United States by as much as 70% in some regions due to global warming.
So 4 inches of rain in 1 hour in Washington, D.C. Did Donald Trump at least have the decency to point that out during his environmental speech?
Of course he didn't. Those heat waves and the insane D.C. rain event provided the perfect backdrop for President Trump's speech on Monday. He promoted his environmental record despite his rollbacks of nationwide limits on air and water pollution, his rollbacks of mileage and emission standards for cars, his wholesale dismantling of U.S. climate policy, flanked by his two senior environmental officials.
Both of them begging people not to look out the window.
And both of them former fossil fuel industry lobbyists. Trump touted gains in U.S. air and water quality that occurred under previous administrations and didn't mention that he has reversed those gains since he took office. Air and water quality have actually declined, and climate warming carbon emissions have gone up in the last 2 years. He didn't even mention the word climate change. He did ramble about cleaning, quote, dirty forest floors.
It's a lot of things happening, but it's management. You can't have dirty floors. You can't have 20 years of leaves and fallen trees, so you can't have that. That's why you have so many fires.
Of course, there's not enough time here to debunk all of the false and misleading claims and outright lies, but this was emblematic of Trump's speech.
We're working hard. I think harder than many previous administrations, maybe almost all of them.
Scientists, environmental policy experts, and groups like the League of Conservation Voters say Trump has the worst environmental record of any president since environmental laws were created. So why did this speech at all? Polls show that voters are turned off by Trump's environmental record, especially women and millennials. The New York Times quotes anonymous campaign sources saying that with the environment and the climate crisis gaining traction in the 2020 presidential campaign, they are attempting to attract voters in swing states.
So if he just shows up and says, I have a great environmental record, supposedly this is going to fool all of those women and other people who are concerned about the environment?
That seems to be the idea.
It just may work.
But finally, some good news. Walmart has announced it's rolling out a network of electric car charging stations across Arkansas and plans to open a national EV charging network. And the U.S. Energy Information Administration has confirmed that in April, for the first time in U.S. history, renewable energy sources generated more electricity than coal for the full month. The bulk of the clean energy came from hydroelectric dams, but solar and wind energy were significant contributors. The decline of coal's pollution is good for anything that breathes.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us, please, planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Trouble ahead, trouble behind, and know that notion just crossed my mind.
Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner is one of the most progressive prosecutors currently in elected office, and Pennsylvania's Republican legislature doesn't like that. They passed legislation signed by the Democratic governor, giving authority to the state's attorney general to prosecute certain firearms violations in Philadelphia.